Revolutions Per Minute is a weekly radio show from the New York City chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America. Recorded live at WBAI 99.5 in Brooklyn every Wednesday at 9 p.m. RPM's about doing the work. The work to build a democratic socialist future. Each week, hear the latest news, analysis, and organizing experience from the minds and hearts of activists fighting every day in New York City. Join the movement at socialists.nyc.
Yo, what's good, New York? This is Jack Devine, he, him pronouns, and you are listening to Revolutions Per Minute, live on WBAI 99.5 FM. We're a socialist radio show and podcast for members of the New York City Democratic Socialists of America. DSA is the largest socialist organization in the United States, with 95,000 members nationwide, and NYC DSA is its biggest chapter. We are run by our 9,000-plus members and organizers who are working together to build democratic socialism in all five boroughs. The formation of the United Auto Workers in the 1930s represented the upsurge in organized working-class militancy that pushed forward a New Deal. Since that time, the UAW has been a base of support for its members that collectively provides for a better life. Yet, the UAW has weakened as its corrupt leadership has chosen compromise with the bosses over a robust internal democracy. That's all about to change. The successful one-member, one-vote referendum has forced open the democratic process and created space for new leadership to rise up. We'll discuss that and much more with UAW members Kay and Chris later in the show. And the UAW now is much more than auto workers. After threatening to strike, the 17,000-member Student Researchers Union of the University of California system won recognition and officially became the newest UAW local. How did these academic workers build a new organization? We heard directly from Kat and Laura of SRU on how they made it happen. Normally, we'd bring you the headlines brought to you by The Thorn, but we're still on our monthly campaign to raise funds for WBAI's Tower Rent. If you love hearing directly from socialists and directly from labor organizers on the airwaves, please give to the station. This is the only kind of place you can hear directly from people who are reporting on the ground, who are engaged in struggle, who are building working-class organization, who are fighting for their lives, who are not paid for by corporate media. This is a different sort of place. We're right in the center of the dial, 99.5 FM. So please give to the station and call 212-209-2950. Again, that number is 212-209-2950. Or you can go to the towerfund.wbai.org. Again, towerfund.wbai.org. And this is, you know, normally we kind of shorten the pitch. We want to get right into the show. But since we're on this special fund drive, I thought it might be a good time to give a special history lesson on Pacifica and why it's such an important radio station and why fighting to be on the signal and going to towerfund.wbai.org is such a great and important way to support the movement overall. Because back when reporter Lewis Hill first proposed the idea of a listener-funded media network that rejected corporate funding at the end of the Second World War, he was laughed off as a delusional utopian. Against all odds, KPFA, the first station in the Pacifica Radio Network, began broadcasting in Berkeley on April 15, 1949. As capitalist media enterprises fully embraced the assault against communists, their fellow travelers, and any labor organizers who were committed to working-class power in the United States, Pacifica Radio emerged as one of the few outposts of resistance against the fascistic purges of the Red Scare and McCarthyism. Anti-war activists were given the rare opportunity to openly condemn the genocidal bombardment of Koreans by American imperialists on the airwaves. Criticisms of the Cold War and willingness to broadcast the views of radicals like Dorothy Healey drew the attention of the House on American Activities Committee and the Senate Internal Security Subcommittee. This is the sort of groundbreaking work that Pacifica has been doing since the beginning. So if you really want to support a radio station that is committed to free speech, go to towerfund.wbai.org. That is towerfund.wbai.org. You can call 212-209-2950. And again, this is just some of the story, because Pacifica did not back down in face of accusations that it was controlled by dangerous subversives and continued to spread its reach across the country. WBAI radio in New York integrated the network in 1960 and quickly earned a reputation for challenging anti-communist narratives propagated by the American ruling class. The station broadcast former FBI agent Jack Levine's expose of J. Edgar Hoover before any other media outlet. WBAI reporter Chris Koch became the first American to cover the anti-colonial struggle for liberation live from North Vietnam. The police arrested station manager Ed Goodman in 1971 when he refused to hand over recorded statements of incarcerated prisoners who were rebelling against the barbaric conditions in the tombs. So again, BAI has been there, you know, covering stories that no one else would cover. BAI has been on the front lines of so many of these kind of awful wars, willing to cover it from a critical perspective rather than just giving the talking points of the Pentagon. So if you want to support a station that really is standing up for working people all around the world, please call 212-209-2950. Again, that number is 212-209-2950, or you can go to towerfund.wbai.org, towerfund.wbai.org. Because it's not just that, you know, Pacifica and WBAI has been there to cover a critical perspective, but they center the voices of those who are struggling for working class power, for internationalism, against racism. When social movements in the United States and revolutionary forces around the world exploded to the surface to contest the power of the American capitalist state during the 1960s, Pacifica Radio proliferated their demands through its airwaves. The network trained volunteers to provide coverage of the civil rights movement directly from the Jim Crow South. Their heroic efforts had deadly consequences as white supremacists murdered Andrew Goodman, son of Pacifica President Robert Goodman, alongside Michael Shermer and James Cheney, as they organized with the Congress for Racial Equality to register black voters during Freedom Summer in Mississippi. Less than a decade later, the Ku Klux Klan bombed the Pacifica station in Houston twice in just 1 year. The producers at Pacifica Radio refused to be intimidated by racist violence as they invited leaders of organizations such as the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and Students for a Democratic Society to discuss their theory and practice on their programs. The network continuously affirmed its commitment to a politics of international solidarity. Pacifica aired a live interview with Che Guevara only a few months before he was assassinated by CIA-backed reactionary forces in Bolivia. 2 years later, the radio network was the first organization willing to take the risk and break Seymour Hersh's story on the My Lai massacre in Vietnam. So once again, BAI has always been there on the front lines, and it's so crucial to protect and fight for this, to hold on to the signal to 99.5 FM so you can sort of hear these sort of stories in the center of the commercial dial without having the cost of having commercial and corporate ownership, but rather a community radio station that is right in the center of the dial. You can call 212-209-2950, 212-209-2950, or go to towerfund.wbai.org. Again, that is towerfund.wbai.org. All right, so now let's get back to our regular scheduled program. Thank you so much for joining us, Kay and Chris.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yes, thank you so much.
Well, let me throw this question to Chris first. What social forces pushed you into the labor movement?
Hi, my name's Chris Viola, I work at, I'm an auto worker for General Motors. I work in Detroit at the Hummer assembly plant, Factory Zero, it's called. And so if you saw Biden running around in that, that would be where I work and the vehicle I work on. I'll say that the social forces that pushed me in, you know, I followed politics for a while. I've been pretty left, I would say. I was following Bernie's run in 2016. It was probably, I followed politics beforehand, but following Bernie, I think he gave a voice to manufacturing workers, auto workers, people who have lost their jobs over the years due to things like NAFTA, that I know have, you know, caused quite a lot of problems in Michigan and much of the manufacturing Midwest and in other places. But what really cemented it for me was the 2019 strike. General Motors, we went on strike in 2019, and I was, you know, I knew it was coming. I didn't think it would be that long. We actually went on strike in 2007. It was for, I want to say, under a day, maybe just a little over a day. But I kind of thought that that's just how strikes were going to be, just really short. And the 2019 strike, you know, I saw, you know, people holding these signs out that said, you know, everyone tier one, and fighting for, you know, keeping our healthcare and things like that. And I was very hopeful for the tentative agreement, and I was a little disappointed at what we passed at the end of that strike. And then I started to just read about labor at that point in time, because I had actually ignored it for pretty much all my life, even though I'm a third generation auto worker. And that's what cemented it for me. Like, I'm like, how do we get out of this? How do we win battles finally? That's what did it for me.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. I think you hit on a couple of notes that a lot of our guests have discussed, although I think you are the first auto worker that we've had on, considering in New York we don't have too much car production. But the fact that, one, the Bernie Sanders campaign was an awakening moment for, I think, a lot of people all across the country of workers who were sick and tired of being treated a certain way in the workplace by politicians. And then on the other front, the key thing that you highlighted is the workplace and workplace struggles, that a strike is kind of the moment that got you activated, really thinking about things on the next level and wanting to participate directly in the movement, that action is motivating even itself, and that through that experience of solidarity, you can start to believe that a different world is possible. It takes organization and organizing. So, Kay, you are a returning guest for us, but I'll throw the same question your direction.
Sure, thanks so much. Hi, I'm Kay Gabriel, pronouns she, her. I live here in New York City, and I am a member of UAW Local 7902, which is among other units. It covers adjuncts at NYU. But this isn't my first time being in, it's my first time having a contract, but it's not my first time being in a union. The forces that pushed me into the labor movement were, in 2014, I, began my PhD at a private university, which was not unionized. And around 2015, we started to hear rumors coming down the pipe about the Columbia grad workers and how they were going to go to the NLRB and they were going to get a decision from the NLRB that would allow them to unionize. And we were sort of like, okay, well, that would cover us as well. So how do we prepare for this? And when that decision, in fact, did come down in 2016, I was part of an initial organizing committee of other grads at my university who began to organize. And then kind of quickly, because of the Trump election and then the change in composition of the NLRB, everyone was like, okay, don't push another case that could reverse this precedent. So we had to change strategy and all this other stuff. Their fight is ongoing. They haven't yet won recognition. But you know, like I finished my program. I'm no longer part of that union. But it was a pretty phenomenal early experience. It was my first experience being an organizer. I was in my early 20s. I didn't know which way was up. And I learned really fast. And it was kind of maybe a different entry into organizing from maybe, of the people who I now work with and some comrades in NYCDSA, for instance, and everyone's path in is a great path. And this one was different because it involved talking to a lot of people who I could not assume really any kind of ideological agreement with. And having to do like walks through departments where people were like, I don't know what a union is, and I don't know why I should be in one. And that was a really interesting initial experience. So that's one kind of, like, lesson that I took from that I think has really shaped my relationship to, like, labor organizing and other organizing now. And the other that I'll just share right here, and I think it's sort of relevant for what we're going to talk about Remember What About, is that one of these experiences with this union that I had was that we had decided to affiliate with a union. It was not UAW, but it was a large national union that did not serve us well and didn't provide us with good leadership. It really wanted a big bargaining unit of like 2,500 people, but it was not willing to put in the resources or the training necessary to actually organize us so we could get the unit and we could get the contract we needed. And I think that this was also an experience of going like, okay, union leadership and the way that union leadership builds rank and file power or refuses to build rank and file power really changes the strength of a union.
Absolutely. I think it's always better to have a union no matter what, but it's sort of strategy and of the leadership and the way that leadership and membership are related in this strategy is so critical in actually having a fighting union that is as effective as possible for the members. And I think it's interesting you highlight, I think, what is such a crucial aspect, I think, of organizing when you're building a new working class institution like a new union is that you have to be able to talk to people. And I think a union is a place where you can build this sort of broader movement that we need because you have to bring together so many different people organized around a central struggle. And that's what's happening just when you're trying to build a new union, but it's also what's happening when you're trying to fight for a more democratic union. You can really touch on all these new issues that maybe you wouldn't have had in a conversation before. You can start to talk about politics in a new way. So we've been kind of hitting around it, but I think now is the time to ask, what is the one member, one vote campaign? How were you able to win this referendum, and why is it such an important fight for UAW membership? And I'll throw this to Chris first, and then Kay, just feel free to add on whatever you want.
Yeah, so one member, one vote campaign was our elections are for our international elected board or electoral board are done through a conventional delegate system, and after the UAW corruption scandal, which I believe over a dozen, I can't remember the exact number because I feel like it changes from time to time, over a dozen people were charged with various ways of taking bribes or embezzlement, that sort of thing. People were upset, and I say rightfully so. You know, you always hear, oh, unions are corrupt, but not like, you know, taking money from the membership corrupt, but more like, you know, corrupt in with the Democratic Party, stuff like that. But after that, there was a motion, movement in within UAW members, like on like Facebook groups and stuff, to start pushing for one member, one vote, pushing for part of our constitution to bring up at our meetings, our local meetings, to see if we can get enough people to sign, enough groups, enough locals to sign for being able to vote for the electoral board, so president, vice president, treasurer, et cetera, by a silent vote. And this would change, I think, the dynamic completely because at the delegates, the conventions, the delegates tend to vote for the incumbent or their hand-picked successor over 90%. I want to say even over 99%. And I don't think that's democracy. Like, you know, I mentioned I like Bernie Sanders. If Bernie Sanders won an election by about 99%, I would say that seems a little weird, you know. So we started pushing for that. I ended up getting stopped in the middle of our efforts, just shy of, I believe, I can't remember the exact numbers that we were trying to hit percentage. I think it was about 20% of the represented locals have to say we're going to call for a constitutional convention and then start to hammer out these rules for a one-member, one-vote system. COVID hit, and then a lot of our, at least in auto, we weren't having meetings. We don't really do meetings online. From, I want to say, April of 2020 up through June or July of this year. There were very few meetings, if any at all. Some places, some locals had their meetings online. But what ended up happening at the end of the the federal probe of the UAW was they put it to a vote. There was a referendum vote in which all UAW members, retired and active, were sent a ballot, and the ballot would say, do you want to move on to this new voting system? They called direct elections, where you would vote for president, vice president, leaders of the different regions, or do you want to stick with the current convention delegate system? So with, I mentioned groups pushing for one member, one vote. One was UAWD, United All Workers for Democracy. We started in May of last year to, May of this year, actually, to commemorate the Battle of the Overpass, which was a formative UAW moment in which Walter Reuther and so forth were attacked by Ford Security at the Dearborn Rouge plant. Dearborn's just a town just outside of Detroit, about southwest. So we passed out flyers to let people know, because people weren't really being informed. They weren't talking about it at meetings because meetings weren't really happening. It might have seemed embarrassing, maybe, to some folks to actually even talk about the referendum and the reason why the referendum was happening. Or as many would say, maybe they didn't want to seem like they were, putting their fingers on the scale. But so the one member, one vote campaign that we ran was we was more of an awareness campaign, just to let people know that, hey, this is coming up. And you could tell based on, like, I did some flyering at the Rouge plant, huge plant, so many people at another plant that's relatively new. And the plant that was relatively new knew nothing about it. The one that's the Rouge plant was 600, a bit more entrenched, kind of more or less aware of it, but not quite so much. It still was, the awareness was very low, but it was like next to nothing at like the Mack Avenue Jeep plant. So what we did was kind of very similar to how the Bernie Sanders campaign, I mentioned, liking him, I ended up being a volunteer for Union Members for Bernie. And it was very similar to that, or if anyone listening was a like a Bernie, what was it called? Victory Captain, where you would, we would put out a forum online and said, sign a pledge and say that you'd be willing to talk to your coworkers, your friends, your union siblings, et cetera, about this. And then we'd actually call them and talk to them and see what they would be willing to do. Would they be willing to pass out flyers? Would they be willing to, make calls? Would they be willing to text friends, and just meet up and, kind of just like have a moment where here's, 10 people on Zoom all, or more than that, some days. All making calls or texting or whatever, just trying to get the word out, or passing out flyers. And we passed out, several hundred thousand, or at least 100,000 I know of. And that was our strategy. That was what we went for. And we won it pretty handily, 2-1, which I was very, very happy with.
It's just so badass. Yeah. The numbers are incredible. And one thing I want to highlight is, the locals that went really hard for one member, one vote, it was Otto went for one member, one vote by enormous margins, by like 70% or 80% at these big Otto locals, which are, some of the kind of like the strongholds of UAW, some of the oldest UAW locals, as well as newer ones like the higher ed locals. UC grads voted by enormous numbers for one member, one vote. So did my local 7902, which is also, it's also higher ed. So it's like there's across sectors and across regions People were really into this reform. And Jack, the other thing that I think is really important for RPM listeners to know is that, you know, like, this reform is, yes, it's about building a democratic union, and building, like, a union that's driven by rank-and-file power and rank-and-file democracy, but it's also about breaking the power of the extremely corrupt administration caucus, which governed, effectively, UAW for the past, what is it, like, 70 years? And which, in the 80s, under situations of economic crisis, piloted a strategy of concessionary bargaining and what's so-called givebacks, where, you know, wages and benefits that the union had won over the course of decades, they decided to give back to the company so that management wouldn't close down plants and move jobs to other places. And so instead of building worker power to prevent people losing jobs and losing the benefits they needed for those jobs to be good jobs, the administration caucus piloted contracts and forced contracts on members that were like really that were extremely pro-company. And then despite these concessions, they were able to stay in power because of the delegate voting system that Chris talked about, which involved things like bullying convention delegates at the conventions in Detroit and other things like this, right? And so the one member, one vote victory is really about, like, it's, you know, yes, we want a democratic union and we want a powerful union. We want a winning union. We want a union that can help members become strike ready, that can get contracts that don't have two tiers, right? That can, you know, fight for a living wage and just cause termination for higher ed workers, you know, for adjuncts who are making poverty wages. So these are like, this is like the stakes of the fight, and this is why it feels so cool that we, you know, frankly, absolutely steamrolled the opposition.
It seems like an absolutely incredible victory for anyone who's looking for the working class to strike back against decades of austerity, against deals cut with bosses, and for fighting militant unions. And I think one thing that's been a key part of militant unions and fighting unions for a long time is having a working class media. For a long time, you had newspapers and other forms of media that was created by the unions themselves that were so crucial. If you want to go back and look into see what happened, the Toledo Autolite strike in 1934, you can go back and you can look at the union's newspaper. And so that's something that we like to do here on WBAI, and that's what we're doing today, is we're highlighting the work of labor organizers. We have three labor organizers who are having a conversation right now, and we're going to be hearing from two more later in the show. And if you want to support that kind of media and you want to hear that on the airwaves on 99.5 FM, then you need to go to towerfund.wbai.org. Again, that's towerfund.wbai.org. You can call 212-209-2950. The number is 212-209-2950. It's absolutely essential to be having sort of media that is highlighting these voices, not just the voices of company spokesmen, rather than what you're going to hear when you're actually talking to a worker who has to go and grind every single day. You're not going to hear about, there's probably been nothing on any of the televised media about what's happening in the UAW, which is one of the largest unions in America. And it's not the only sort of democratic struggle that's happening. And we're going to hopefully discuss later in the show how this one member, one vote relates to something, other struggles that happened to Teamsters recently. But before we do that, I just want to ask you both briefly, why would you both of you think it's so important to have media that isn't controlled by corporate America? Just a brief 30-second answer. Kay, I'll throw that to you.
Yeah, totally. like, powerful interests are going to defend themselves and they're going to look out for their own, right? And a moment when, you know, billionaires made, I think, like, cumulatively, like, $1 trillion in the U.S., in the first 9 months of the pandemic. And at a moment when a bunch of other social forces, you know, people are, they're not able to get adequate food. They don't have healthcare. They're being, forced back to work right now by the CDC. You know, at this moment, the wealthiest, people in the U.S. are, and around the world, are enriching themselves and they're protecting their own interests by way of the media, to shape public consciousness, so, you know, they can do, like, nice, instead of this, right, instead of this, like, kind of, like, propaganda for, like, corporate America and for capitalists and for people who own everything, we could have working class media that's funded by listeners, that can uplift real struggles.
Well, we absolutely need media that is highlighting the struggles of working class people and not highlighting the space flights of Jeff Bezos and friends. And if you want media that does that, call 212-209-2950. Again, 212-209-2950, or go to towerfund.wbai.org. Again, that's towerfund.wbai.org. We want to keep this sort of working class media on the air. We want to keep union organizers on the air. We want to keep people who are fighting for the people on the air in this sort of free speech radio where you're not going to, this sort of stuff that you're not going to hear on CNN, Fox News, MSNBC. This is the sort of difference making media for working people that we need to keep on the air. So go to towerfund.wbai.org. And a week ago, I spoke with Kat and Laura, two student researchers from the University of California system, who recently won their struggle for union recognition of their 17,000-member union after threatening to go on strike. Let's roll that clip right now.
So we are here with Kat Dale and Laura Chappelle of the Student Researchers Union. Thank you both so much for joining us on Revolutions Per Minute.
Thanks for having us.
Glad to be here.
So we just want to give our audience a brief breakdown of what you guys have actually been building out there in the University of California system and in Santa Cruz in particular. So can you just let our audience know, what is the Student Researchers Union? How did you build this new working class organization? And why did you see it as an important way to improve your life?
Yeah, so Student Researchers United is the union for student researchers. So at the University of California, that's graduate students who perform research as part of their training, but it's also work. We do work for the university. And maybe it's helpful to have kind of a broad history of Student Researchers United. So back in 1999, when the TAs began to form their union at the UC, they actually tried to include student researchers, grad students who didn't do TA positions, but they were still working for the university. And due to kind of an unfair argument, the UC was able to exclude student researchers, effectively cutting that union in half and only including TAs. So this has been a decades-long fight to get student researchers to be unionized. Back in 2017, a Senate bill was passed, Senate Bill 201, that legally redefined student researchers as employees and not just students. So it wasn't until 2017 we actually had the legal right to unionize. And it's just taken a couple of years for the campaign to get off the ground.
Kat, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, I'll just say that sort of the importance of forming this is because right now or before this new union was formed, all student researchers really didn't have any sort of bargaining power or voice at the university. So prior to having a union, the UC decides what's best for us, and we really have no say in any of our working conditions. Despite, as Laura said, we're doing work for the UC. We are the backbone of the UC as graduate student researchers.
And many grad students fluctuate between being a TA and being solely a grad student researcher. So there will be one quarter where I am protected by a union and another quarter where I'm not. So there's a lot of fluidity with these positions, and it's just mind-boggling that we can't unionize everybody and protect all grad students every quarter. And now we can with the formation of SRU.
So it gives, because of the way that the work structure is, and as a university worker, I've experienced this out. Luckily, as a member of PSC, we have everyone covered under the union contract, except for there are some exceptions to the rules where people have certain fellowships that if they're not getting paid hourly. So I understand the same sort of struggle in that this sort of student researchers have been, even though they're doing the labor, that without their labor, the university would not function. You lacked collective organization, lacked protection, but now have this sort of collective organization that can provide you the sort of, not just protection, but power that you need in order to have the sort of wages or cost of living adjustments that you can actually live in a place like Santa Cruz, where the rent is, I believe, extremely high from what I've been hearing.
Astronomical. And it's only getting worse. Yeah.
Yeah, so that's sort of where this fight also fits in a larger context, thinking about how unions and worker power can really improve not only graduate student researchers' lives, but sort of the lives of other people in our community. And this is basically an example of what happens when workers get together and fight for their rights. So we're hoping that some of the things that we bargained for in our first contract will be things like a cost of living adjustment. And hopefully that will set a precedent for other academic student employees and maybe state or local community members as well. I feel like this could be a great example of what happens when people get together.
Exactly. And it's something that we've been seeing all over the country, especially in higher education, where workers are coming all together. This was not the only major unionization that's occurred over the past couple months. You had University of Pittsburgh workers, 3,000, come together to form a union. And the same thing just happened at, I believe, the University of New Mexico. So this sort of labor movement within higher education is growing and growing more powerful. And hopefully the sort of cost of living adjustments that you're fighting for is something that can be replicated across the board. So what sort of strategy did you use in order to win recognition? Why is the threat to strike such a powerful tool of working class power? And how did you make that a credible threat?
Yeah, so we did a lot of one-on-one organizing. And I would just stress that this is so key to activating folks. We did walkthroughs. We had individual conversations with our colleagues. We sent texts and emails. And through that, we really had conversations about people's working conditions and why having union and going on strike is such a powerful tactic. We did have a lot of different strategies to getting recognition. So we had a lot of legislative support, not only from our California legislators, but also at the federal level as well. There was a whole legal battle going on that was mediated by our state labor board, PERB. There were a lot of discussions between the UC, UAW, and PERB about recognition. And then we had our community allies as well. But definitely the threat of striking was our most powerful tool in our toolbox.
Definitely.
For sure.
Yeah, I just want to add that we started collecting signatures, authorization cards back in late 2020, when the pandemic was still raging and people were still quarantining, and we didn't have an online option. So it really forced us to see people in person, which one was difficult. We weren't allowed to social distance. We had to social distance at that point. But I think it helped forcing us to see people one-on-one and kind of empathizing and engaging in those conversations to build power, build a network of people who really wanted to be involved and engaged. And it was difficult, but it was fun. And yeah, it was just like what Kat was saying, one-on-one conversations and really engaging people. And then that strike authorization vote that went down. So it took us over 10 months to collect roughly 11,000 authorization cards. We collected about the same number of votes in 10 days. And it was only a few months later. So it just shows how exponential the growth can be when you start with a few people and keep going.
Yeah, it's one of those moments where you sort of demystify what organizing is all about, where it's really these sort of one-on-one conversations. And obviously under the conditions of COVID, it makes things far more difficult in order to sort of build those relationships that are necessary to demonstrate power moving forward. And the fact that you were able to get that many strike authorization cards signed when the union had not been like fully recognized yet is, I think, a really reveals the strength of one, the set of demands that you've put forward, the sense that there is a need at the university for this sort of organization, and that this sort of commitment that the lead organizers took. So I think it's incredibly impressive that you were able to, you know, build to that credible strike threat, that one union recognition after all. And it wasn't the only strike threat that was happening at the University of California. At the same time, I believe both the lecturers and the others graduate workers, the postdoctorate candidates were also threatening to strike. So, and that's just a continuation of what was happening in February of 2020 when there was a wildcat strike at the University of California system. So I'm just curious, how do you see yourselves as part of a broader movement at the University of California specifically and in higher education more broadly? And what are your demands as you move forward into your next fight?
So I'll let Laura talk about the demands, but I can certainly talk about sort of where we fall with the other unions. Yes, we are one of several groups at the University of California that are unionized. And really excitingly, we're actually all moving into bargaining at the same time in early winter, starting in February. So that's the teaching assistants, tutors, and readers. That's UAW 2865. And then UAW 5810, which are postdocs and academic researchers. All of us are bargaining at once, which is really exciting to think about some of these more joint demands that we can make. And it is really exciting thinking about the wildcat strike. You're actually talking to two grads who were at UC Santa Cruz when the wildcat strike happened back in 2020. And one of the reasons why it didn't end with the conclusion that the workers were hoping with, which was a cost of living adjustment of about $1,400 a month for all graduate students. One of the reasons why that didn't happen was because only half of grads at UC Santa Cruz had any sort of collective bargaining power. So this, having this new union, will mean that all grads and postdocs across the whole UC will have that voice with the UC. And that's really an exciting moment for us to go into bargaining and make some of these demands.
Definitely. And some of the demands that we want to make are that one of the big ones is wages, some sort of cost of living adjustment to bring Santa Cruz and other UCs in high rent areas into parity with each other. Another huge thing that came up with conversations from our colleagues was PI bullying. So the PI is your advisor, essentially, who oversees your work. And there have been so many cases where there's bullying or sexual harassment or forms of harassment and discrimination, and a lot of grad students want protections from that and ways to get out if they need to leave the lab, financial help if that's an issue, and other things we're fighting for are more rights for international students, more protections for international students, and just job security, in case people get hurt on the job. There's really no formal grievance process in case things go wrong. So protections around, you know, when you're working in a lab, there's dangerous chemicals, there's machines you can hurt yourself on. And I've known people who have gotten hurt and haven't been compensated. So these are just some of the things that we've talked about in putting into our very first contract.
Yeah, so it's more than just cost of living adjustments, which are obviously essential and such, I mean, for anywhere that anyone lives, for workers, but it's about dignity in the workplace. It's about having a safe and healthy workplace. It's about standing in solidarity with other students that have exceptional cases. You want to protect them as well. So it's kind of a set of almost a social justice union sort of push where you're broadening the set of demands more than just bread and butter, but for a union that fights for everybody.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Grad students can't perform good research if they're not feeling safe in their working conditions.
I also feel like a union is a way to elevate students who are traditionally marginalized or first-generation graduate students who the graduate school system is really challenging to navigate. And sometimes it's just really unclear about how to advocate for yourself, right? Like do this self-advocacy. So having a body behind you, a union who can advocate on your behalf, who you can file a grievance with if you're having a problem, is such a powerful tool. And I really firmly believe that this is a way to improve all graduate students' working conditions, but especially those who are maybe new to graduate school or historically marginalized.
Yeah, the way that collective power can kind of undermine marginalization and kind of put everyone, maybe not an equal playing field, but it give them the chance to fight back and kind of have dignity and respect at the workplace is absolutely crucial. So is there anything before I have to let you both go that you guys want to let our listeners know how they can support the union or anything that they should pay attention to moving forward?
I mean, I'd say everyone should unionize. I think the power of collective bargaining is huge. And we've seen that with strikes that have happened across the country. Kellogg's won. We boycotted. They won their demands. And we're seeing this movement of labor action, across the country. You know, Starbucks in New York has unionized, Amazon in Alabama are going to re-vote. I'd say, you know, pay attention, know your power, and fight for yourself, fight for better working conditions. I'd love to see everybody in the country unionize.
When we fight, we win.
When we fight, we win.
Absolutely. And we're hoping to continue the fight in higher education here in New York as well, as we're struggling for a new deal for CUNY and also potentially moving towards a strike. So maybe we can get some strikes on both coasts at the same time as we move forward to...
Love it. That'd be beautiful.
Yes, let's do it.
All right. I want to thank you both so much for joining us in Revolutions Per Minute. And we will keep an eye on your struggle out in the University of California system.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to Revolutions Per Minute. I'm listener-sponsored WBAI in New York City, broadcasting 99.5 FM and streaming on your favorite podcast app. We were just talking to organizers from the Student Researchers Union in the University of California system, who recently won union recognition after threatening to go on strike, and also discussing the one-member, one-vote referendum within the UAW. But let's go to Amy Wilson and Sing in Solidarity for a pitch and a rendition of the Internationale.
Good evening to the WBAI community from Amy Wilson for Revolutions Per Minute. You're listening to the Internationale, the famous left-wing anthem performed live outdoors in Brooklyn earlier this month by the New York City DSA chorus Sing in Solidarity. This song has inspired generations of socialists to fight for a better world for the international working class, something that we here at Revolutions Per Minute believe can be achieved within our lifetime through stories like the ones you're hearing tonight of people fighting for democracy in their workplace and at their unions. If you agree that these stories are vitally important to keep on the air on WBAI 99.5 FM, please don't miss your chance to give your tax-deductible contribution to WBAI's Tower Fund at the end of this year. Please call 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. Or go to towerfund.wbai.org to make your gift today. Let's hear more from Sing in Solidarity. You're listening to Sing in Solidarity, performing Workers of the World Awaken by American labor activist and folk songwriter Joe Hill, a member of the Industrial Workers of the World. Here at Revolutions Per Minute, we love being able to preserve the stories, thoughts, and sentiments of this generation of socialist and labor activists, so that these lessons can be passed down through many generations of struggle. If you support this mission and the mission of WBAI to give a voice to the working class of New York, please call 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. Or go to towerfund.wbai.org. Our fund drive is ending at the end of this year, so please don't forget to make your donation to our Tower Fund today. Now, let's go back to Jack Devine in the studio for more from the front lines of struggle.
All right. Thank you, Amy Wilson. And remember, if you want to keep the International on the airwaves, please call 212-209-2950, 212-209-2950, or go to towerfund.wbai.org. Again, that's towerfund.wbai.org. And we have only about a minute left in the show, so we're not going to be able to get to our listener callers today, but I want to give Chris and Kay at least a final note to end on. So for everyone listening to the show, how does this relate to other movements for democratic unionism that are happening across the U.S. right now? Or kind of, is there just anything you want our listeners to be aware of, anything they can do to support the campaign as the UAW members move forward to elect a new leadership? Chris, I'll let you go first, and then Kay, if you want to add on just briefly.
The way we're fighting, what we're fighting for and what we're fighting against is very similar to what all the other unions are fighting against. The previous interview, you were talking to folks who mentioned Kellogg's. Kellogg's is fighting against two-tier systems. Two-tier systems are essentially contracts for people that are hired past a certain date. It's multiple contracts. People who will then have, workers will then have you know, fewer benefits, fewer pay, less pension, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that's what we're all fighting against. It's the same struggle in, I want to say, every union, it seems like, the more I pay attention to it. So if you're in UAW, please go to uawd.org and join us if you want to continue fighting for workplace democracy. Teamsters for Democratic Union, of course. Search them. I actually don't know their address off the top of my head. I think it's cdu.org. And talk to us if you're in another union and need help starting a rank and file caucus that wants to educate the membership and prepare for strikes, as Kay had mentioned earlier, and win contracts and defeat these measures, these terrible contracts that are, you know, destroying our solidarity and reducing our quality of life and, you know, making oodles of profits for, you know, the worst people.
Yeah, I'll add on to that. just super quick, you know, like to once again underscore, like, so Teamsters for Democratic Union is the rank and file, one of the rank and file caucuses in the Teamsters. Teamsters won direct elections in 1991 and took them a while, but they finally elected rank and file, or a coalition of rank and file caucuses elected new leadership against the leadership that I had, similar to the administration caucus in UAW, negotiated some really bad contracts for the Teamsters. And so that's an incredible victory, right? And so you have these two, like UAW, one member, one vote referendum, and the Teamsters for Democratic Union, and allies victory in.
We got to sign off. Sorry to cut
cool.
you off.
Yeah, just, that's okay. Cool.
Just one final. If you want to finish your thought, just one second.
Yeah, I guess the final thing that I'll say is, you know, if you're a UAW member, join UAWD. Take our survey for democratic power, for so we know what to fight for in the next year.
Well, I want to thank you both so much, Kay and Chris, for joining us on Revolutions Per Minute. If you're listening, please go to WBAI and go to towerfund.wbai.org or call in at 212-209-2950. This has been Jack Devine with Revolutions Per Minute. We'll be back with you next week to hear about a report from International Solidarity with Cuba. So this has been Jack Devine and with Revolutions Per Minute. Thank you.